ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts. TJ Quinn, we're here today to talk about a tragedy that shook the entire sport of baseball, but it's one that I think a lot of people have kind of forgotten about since it happened. So I want to start here at the very beginning. It was just about 2.5 years ago, June 30th, 2019, the Los Angeles Angels are in Texas visiting the Rangers. And what happened?
The Angels land. They're in a great mood. Everybody's got a cowboy outfit. They all got new hats and boots and belt buckles. It was a festive flight. They land. They head to the hotel, the Hilton in South Lake, where they had been many times before. And as people headed up to their rooms, Tyler Skaggs, a 27-year-old left-handed starter, headed up to his room. At some point, Skaggs was texting with the team's communications director, a guy named Eric Kay. And he says to Eric Kay, "I want you to come up to my room." At some point that night, Eric Kay went up to his room. Everything else that happened is in dispute. But what we do know is that at some point, Tyler Skaggs lost consciousness. He fell face first on his bed. And then the next morning, his wife, Carly, is wondering why she hasn't heard back from him. Finally, the team decides they've got to do a welfare check. They open the door, and there is Tyler Skaggs, with no shirt on, still with the jeans and the cowboy boots he had, face down in his own vomit and blood. He'd been dead for some time.
The autopsy states that the young Los Angeles Angels pitcher suffocated after ingesting a mix of alcohol and the opioids oxycodone and fentanyl. His family tonight demands answers, saying in a statement, "We will not rest until we learn the truth about how Tyler came into possession of these narcotics, including who supplied them."
So for 2.5 years, we really haven't known what the story was and whether or not somebody was responsible for Tyler Skaggs' death. And now here we are all this time later. Eric Kay, team's communications director, is sitting in a federal courthouse in Fort Worth, Texas, waiting for a jury to decide whether or not he is responsible for Tyler Skaggs' death.
The death of Tyler Skaggs was a shocking tragedy. Immediately, fans flocked to Angel Stadium to pay their respects as moments of silence for the pitcher were observed. And the Angels honored their fallen teammate with a scene that could only play out in Hollywood. But only now, some 2.5 years later, in a Texas courtroom, is the mystery unraveling and a larger truth finally being revealed. Today, TJ Quinn investigates how a culture of opioid abuse and addiction permeated at least one corner of Major League Baseball, and how an Angels executive was allegedly at the center of it all. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, February 17th. This is ESPN Daily. TJ Quinn, where are you right now, man?
I'm in a cookie cutter hotel in downtown Fort Worth, Texas, just maybe a half mile from the federal courthouse.
Yeah, I know you've been commuting to that federal courthouse, TJ, in Fort Worth for the past couple weeks now, covering this trial surrounding the death of Tyler Skaggs in 2019. And I just want to begin here by understanding more about Skaggs himself. Who was he?
Tyler Skaggs was a really talented pitcher.
Wow. Dropped it in there. That's 11 in a row set down by Tyler Skaggs. Tyler Skaggs is pitching a beauty.
He was drafted the same time as Mike Trout by the Angels, but he was a guy who struggled with injuries, you know, early and often.
Tyler Skaggs has thrown the ball very well in his rehab assignments, coming back after nearly out for two full seasons.
He got traded, and then he was traded back to the Angels. Really seemed to be putting it together.
Down goes Rowdy Tellez, one down. Sixth strikeout of the night for Tyler.
Tyler Skaggs is the first Angels starter to get an out in the eighth this season.
He was known as a party guy. He was someone who liked to have a good time, and his friends knew it, his teammates knew it. When they did fun things like the dressing up like cowboys, as we talked about before, he was one of the guys who was the most into it.
And so when Tyler Skaggs is pronounced dead, TJ, on July 1st at 2:18 p.m. in his hotel bed in South Lake, Texas, what did investigators find at that scene?
I mean, we've heard over and over again in court what people saw as they walked into the room. First, team security, and then the police, EMTs. First thing you see was Tyler Skaggs' body face down on the bed, and it was clear that he'd been dead for quite some time. It was also clear that no one had been in the room for very long. Nothing was unpacked. He had his shirt off. He had his cowboy hat off. But then they saw that on his desk, on top of an iPad case, he had crushed up pills. There was residue there. So it was clear that there had to be some sort of drug involvement. There was also a piece of a plastic ballpoint pen that was used presumably to snort it. So the story coming together very quickly for anybody who's in that room.
2 days after Tyler's death, TJ, I remember the scene of the press conference where the Angels are speaking to the public about their thoughts and feelings about what had happened. What do you remember from that scene?
Well, one thing that was unusual was how front and center Mike Trout was. He's usually so reluctant to put himself out there. And on this, he really took the lead.
You know, I can't explain it, man. Lost a teammate, lost a friend, a brother. You know, Skaggs was an unbelievable person. You know, besides baseball, no, this is all about him. You know, he was a, you know, husband, Carly. What a sweet girl. Debbie, his mom, you know. Grew a relationship with them. And, you know, to lose, you know, somebody like him, it's tough, you know.
The whole world was speculating about what was going on. But Mike Trout set the tone that this is our guy and nobody is going to hedge their grief at all. We're going to ignore the circumstances of his death and just talk about a fallen comrade.
I want to fast forward here to 2 weeks after that day, TJ, because the Angels are playing the Mariners at home and the team is honoring Tyler. Tyler's mom, Debbie, throws out the first pitch. Every Angel is wearing the number 45 on that day, Tyler's number. What happened in that game?
We say this a lot. If somebody had pitched it as a movie treatment, you would just laugh at how ridiculous it was. The offense goes 13-0.
Deep out into left center field, Trout out here.
This is an emotional night for everyone, and certainly Trout puts his signature on this moment here tonight for his good buddy Tyler Skaggs.
The pitching staff, Tyler Skaggs' bullpen mates, throw a combined team no-hitter.
And this is ground ball to second base. Brent Hefel falls down, picks it up, fires the first. The Angels have no hit. The Seattle Mariners.
The entire team embraced as one out there on the field.
And then when the game is over, they took the number 45 jerseys that they were wearing and they laid them on the mound. Absolutely unbelievable.
The 45 jerseys being placed on the mound.
This is absolutely indescribable. This is the most amazing moment I've ever seen.
After that, cinematic episode, TJ, the toxicology report is released. What did that report show?
The autopsy report showed that Tyler Skaggs died of asphyxiation after vomiting. He basically choked on his vomit. And the toxicology showed that he had ingested oxycodone, fentanyl, and alcohol. Now, the cause of death was listed as the asphyxiation, but it was those drugs that jumped out.
And the one that especially jumps out, TJ, seems to be fentanyl, which is a synthetic opioid, roughly 80 to 100 times more powerful than morphine. It's added often to other illegal drugs without the user even being aware of it. It's one of the biggest causes of overdose deaths in our country. And so after this toxicology report comes out, Billy Epler, who was at the time the Angels general manager, he holds this press conference and he says,
there was a report that that came out today, that surfaced today. I can just say that we were saddened by that report that came out and completely heartbroken. Everyone's searching for facts, and everyone within the organization wants facts, which is why we are actively cooperating with an investigation.
How did you hear that? And how do you hear that now, 2.5 years later?
The reality is that the team pretty much knew the circumstances of his death within a day. They knew about the drugs that were found in the room. They knew that he was a user. They had already spoken to police. And by that point, the DEA had decided that they were interested in what was going on. So, yeah, Epler was right that they were going to cooperate. But the fact was, everybody in that team already knew the circumstances. They just didn't know the details, the amounts, or specifically what the drugs were.
So the key figure in all of this is Eric Kay. That is the man on trial. That is the person that you're at the courthouse to see. How do you begin to describe his deal? Who is he?
Eric Kay was the son of a Los Angeles Rams outside linebacker, Rich Kay, who died in a single car accident when Eric was a kid. Apparently, his father had his own problems with painkillers and suffered with depression. And Eric fought depression his entire life. When he got out of school, he got an internship with then, I believe, the Anaheim Angels and worked his way up through the communications department until finally, when the spot opened up, he became the head of communications. It's an exhausting, thankless job sometimes, but if you're in the business, it's what you want to do. You're there. You're the guy for the players and the media. And all through those years, as he struggled with depression, he played around with different medications until one day he discovered oxycodone and found that that drug made him feel like nothing else did. And from that point on, he was hooked. Now, I'm saying all this, you know, definitively. The fact is, it was his mother who told me all this when I spoke to her 2 years ago. She and Eric's soon-to-be ex-wife were so fed up with the drug use that she actually talked to me on the record and talked about what he had been through and how far his addiction had gone.
TJ, just to zoom out here for a second on the job that Eric Kay was doing, director of communications for a Major League Baseball team, what is that relationship typically like between that guy and the players on the team?
That is a huge point in this trial. The government is making the case that Eric Kay was essentially Tyler Skaggs' drug dealer. And the story that the defense wants the jury to know is that there is this ridiculous imbalance of power. The PR guy may be team staff, but he works at the pleasure of the players. You do what the players want. If the players want a tea time, you set it up. If they want to talk to the media, you're the conduit for that. If they want a reservation, if they want a special favor done for somebody. The communications directors know so much that reporters would love to know. They are the keepers of the secrets. I mean, they're around for a lot. So they are around the players, but they also know that, no, their job is keep those guys in uniform happy.
So how does that person, Eric Kay, become implicated in the death of Tyler Skaggs?
Right after Tyler Skaggs died, Eric Kay's assistant realized, you know, I do know somebody who was on that trip who does have a history of drug use, and that's Eric Kay. Eric Kay had just been in rehab for a month earlier that same season. So he tipped off the police that you might want to look at this guy. But it wasn't long after police got the phone and then gave it to the DEA that, I mean, this was not a sophisticated operation. I mean, there were numerous texts between Tyler Skaggs and Eric Kay. There were Venmo transactions. It was all laid out there.
TJ, if this all seems very plainly laid out, where does the investigation go from there?
Well, that was a huge question, is should there even be an investigation? The death was ruled accidental. Nobody was in the room with him. The DEA actually had two investigations going at the same time. One was out of the field office in Los Angeles, and the other was out of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We reported, just a short time after that, that Eric Kay went into the DEA and he told them that he had been an addict for years. And then all of a sudden, his main connection dried up and he's desperate. He starts asking around the team, anybody he can think of who might have some kind of oxycodone connection. And one day he says, Tyler Skaggs walks up to him and said, you and I have something in common. And at that point, Eric Kay told the DEA that Tyler Skaggs said, here's how it's going to work. I'm going to introduce you to a guy. Tyler Skaggs said, I'll pay for drugs for both of us, but you're going to do all the transactions. Described it as a classic I buy, you fly arrangement between the two of them. And from that point on, it seemed to work well for several years. Eric Kay also said that Tyler Skaggs was the first person who taught him to crush up oxycodone and snort it, which was a whole different level of use and addiction. So I spoke to a couple of key law enforcement sources who knew exactly what was going on with this investigation. And they said the plan at the time was that the DEA office in LA had wrapped up what it was doing, and the one out of Dallas was going to wrap its investigation up shortly without any charges. They did not really think that there was a crime that had been committed.
So how do we go from there is no crime here, this is per the DEA's multiple offices on this subject, to an indictment and a grand jury and a criminal complaint?
Months started to go by and I was reaching out to people saying, what's going on? And people who were close to this were saying, we have no idea. We thought it would be a wrap by now. And then all of a sudden,
Eric Kay was arrested and had his first appearance in federal court this morning in Fort Worth. A criminal complaint just unsealed Friday says Kay may have been distributing pills since 2017 or even before.
Then, October 2020, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Texas announces that Eric Kay has been indicted on two charges, distributing an opioid, fentanyl, and causing the death of Tyler Skaggs.
Today, I can confirm that the United States Attorney for the Northern District of Texas charged former Angels Communication Director Eric Prescott Kay for distributing the fentanyl that killed Tyler Skaggs.
And there was a key line in the press release that they gave out that day saying that it was later ascertained that but for the fentanyl, and those two words, but for, keep coming up over and over, Tyler Skaggs would be alive. Now, that was news to a number of people because the official autopsy report was that it was asphyxiation after he vomited. It was not an OD. But now, all of a sudden, the government is saying, no, the fentanyl is what killed him. So they were saying that, one, Eric Kay gave him the pills. Two, they had fentanyl and the fentanyl killed him. And three, it took place in the state of Texas. Now he's potentially facing federal jail time.
After the break, what we've learned in the trial of Eric Kay for the death of Tyler Skaggs.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
All right, TJ, I want to talk about what you've actually been seeing in that courtroom at Eric Kay's trial these past couple weeks, because we should note that there were no cameras or recording devices allowed at trial, but you've been there in these proceedings each day as our eyes and ears. So just to reiterate, What is Eric Kay charged with?
He's got two felony counts, one of distributing an opioid, fentanyl, and the other is distributing fentanyl and causing the death of Tyler Skaggs. It's not a homicide charge. It's more he's responsible for. It's serious enough, but it's not murder.
And how does the government go about trying to prove those charges beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, they've got to show that, one, Eric Kay gave Tyler Skaggs the pills that he took that night, B, that he did it in Texas so that they have jurisdiction, and C, that the fentanyl in those drugs is what killed him. That's really the key to their case. The original autopsy, which was done by then Deputy Medical Examiner Mark Krause, he found that it was accidental, that the drugs certainly contributed to the death, but he asphyxiated on his vomit. And when he's asked in court, can you say to a certainty that but for the fentanyl, Tyler Skaggs would be alive? And he said, no, I can't say that. The fentanyl made it more likely, but it's either greater or lesser probability, not a certainty. On Tuesday, before the government rested its case, it brought in another expert, a toxicologist named Dr. Stacey Hale, who was, I think, objectively the most effective witness the government has brought so far. She laid out this case that the symptoms of someone who is overdosing on opioids is completely different than someone who has had too much to drink, saying that in her mind, there was no question that it was the fentanyl. So here's the thing. There are tons of technical details that these jurors are being bombarded with. And at the end of the day, what really matters is whose story do they believe? Do they believe the government that Eric Kay is a drug dealer and that fentanyl killed Tyler Skaggs? Or do they believe Eric Kay that he's a fellow addict, wrong place, wrong time? We don't know what caused his death.
So on top of the question about whether there's 100% certainty that it was the oxycodone or the fentanyl that killed Tyler Skaggs, there's also the question of whether Eric Kay was definitively the one who gave him the pills, actually, that night. What do we know about that question?
This part of the government's case is largely circumstantial, and I don't mean that in the way most people misunderstand that word to mean insignificant or, you know, some have some kind of phony reasoning. No, circumstantial evidence is real evidence. But what they've got is a series of texts that took place earlier on June 30th, before the team left, where Tyler Skaggs is asking Eric Kay, I need a few. And he says, how many? And he says, not many, like five. It's pretty clear to everybody that they're talking about drugs. Then when they get to Texas and they get settled in their hotel rooms late that night, Skaggs texts Kay and says, come up to my room, 469. And Eric Kay says, Kay. He went up to his room, says that Tyler Skaggs had three lines of pills already crushed and laid out there, handed him that empty part of the pen to snort and said, you're up. You know, again, this is Eric Kay's story. What the government is saying is that it is clear from these exchanges that this is what Tyler Skaggs is looking for and that Eric Kay went up to his room to give him the pills. Because there's no other evidence. There's no witness. There's nothing forensic that shows that Eric Kay handed him those pills. So it's who the jury believes.
Given that, TJ, how would you describe what the defense's task is here?
You know, the burden is on the prosecution to get guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And the defense just has to poke holes any place they can to create that doubt. They're doing it in how evidence was collected. They're doing it in how many opportunities someone might have had to get to Tyler Skaggs before that team plane left, trying to show that he could have roamed that hotel freely that night and gotten it from anybody else. Anything that they can do, because what they need really is one juror to say, I don't think there's enough to convict, and that's enough to get a hung jury. And then it's up to whether the government's going to refile the case or not. It's hard to see right now how it goes 12-0 either way. Don't know if we'll get a straight acquittal. Don't know if we'll get a straight conviction. But all they want is for enough jurors, just one, if that's all they can get, to say the government didn't do their job.
Early in this trial, the government, the prosecution, brings as a witness to the stand Debbie Hetman, Tyler Skaggs' mom. In a trial like this, I imagine, TJ, that there's a moment, especially when a mom is involved, that is sort of particularly chilling or memorable. Was there a moment like that with Debbie on the stand?
Oh, I mean, just seeing her walk up there was chilling enough. And everybody in the room, you know, suddenly realizes this is the closest connection we've got to Tyler Skaggs at this point. And she was pretty even throughout the whole thing until the end in cross-examination, when she talked about how angry she was that in her mind, Eric Kay was the last person to see her son alive and that he could have done something. Now, there's no evidence to say that he was the last person who saw him or that he could have done anything. But you saw this mother's anger and the defense attorney, Michael Malfetta, in this position of how hard do I challenge her? But it was this moment where her grief and her anger kind of broke through all this dry testimony we'd seen.
TJ, I understand that Tyler Skaggs' wife, as well as his mother, took the stand. What did you see from her?
Everyone had heard about Carly Skaggs throughout. I mean, this is the woman who lost her husband, who she'd been married to just for a matter of months. She was asked at the beginning, "Who are you to Tyler Skaggs?" And she said, "I'm his wife." And then she paused. And then she said, "Widow." And there was absolute silence in that courtroom. There was a tough exchange toward the end. During cross-examination, Michael Malfetta, the defense attorney we mentioned before, he brought up two texts that she sent to him that night that we had not heard about before. The first was, "Don't you get drunk and fall asleep without saying goodnight to me." And then when she hadn't heard from him, he asked her while she was on the stand if she remembered sending one saying, "You have a drinking problem. I'm going to tell Tom Taylor, who's the team's traveling secretary, all about it." And that was where we saw some real steel in her. And she said, "What you're describing is a text that I sent in anger that wasn't true when I couldn't reach my husband who couldn't answer me because he was dead." And that just took everything out of that courtroom. That was the end of her testimony. Then she went and sat with Tyler's mother.
Wednesday, TJ, is when the defense presented. But it was noticeably short, it seems. Only a few witnesses were called, and then they rested their case. But I wanted to ask you about their presentation, because the defense chose, notably, to not call Eric Kay to the stand. What did you make of that decision?
I don't want to speculate too much. I mean, from my conversations with people in the court, you know, for the last week and also covering this case, there is always a huge risk in putting somebody up there. I think there was a sense that if they've poked enough holes in the government's case, they've done it, and that the risk of putting Eric Kay up there was just too great. You just don't know what's going to happen. This is a guy who's been, you know, pretty emotionally fragile at points over the last couple of years, speaking to members of his family. So why risk it?
And so closing arguments, those take place today, and then this just goes to jury from there?
That's it. They banged out the rules over jury instructions. Each side is going to get 45 minutes to make its case. There have been a lot of lawyers in that courtroom, and I keep asking each of them that I can get a hold of every day, "What do you think? What do you think?" And they always say the same thing. They feel like, you know, maybe the defense did enough to poke some holes. But what you keep hearing people repeat, whether they're party to this or not, is A, it's a jury and you never know. And B, it's Texas. Texas is just a little different. So nobody really seems to know how to read this.
Okay, TJ, after the break, four major leaguers take the stand to testify in the trial of Eric Kay and what they've revealed about the culture of drug use in Major League Baseball.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Shopping for Mother's Day is usually a challenge because you people wait until the last minute. But Macy's Gift Finder makes it incredibly fast and easy to find the right gift just in time for Mother's Day. Whether you're shopping for your sister's first one or for your fashionista mom who likes to make a statement, Macy's Gift Finder has so many great gift ideas that you can easily pick out something special to celebrate with them both. You can shop by price anywhere from $25 and under to, say, $100 and below. You can also sort by category like fragrance, handbags, and more. Or gift lists, like for the mom who has everything. Or even pre-wrapped gifts for grandma. Find top brands like Studio Pro Model Beats headphones, Polaroid cameras, and Samsung smart TVs. So, what are you waiting for? Mother's Day is May 12th and it'll be here before you know it. Macy's has the perfect gift guide to make picking something for mom easy this year. Head to Macy's.com/giftfinder today. That's Macy's.com/giftfinder.
So, TJ, regardless of whether Eric Kay is found guilty or not in this specific trial, we have been learning a whole lot about drug use inside of Major League Baseball clubhouses. And we know this because of testimony from a number of teammates of Tyler Skaggs from the Angels. We're talking about Matt Harvey. We're talking about CJ Krohn, Mike Morin, Cam Bedrosian. And it's important to note that all of those guys, all those players who testified here, received immunity, so they could not be prosecuted. But I want to start with Matt Harvey here, of course, a huge star on the Mets in New York a few years ago. He testified on Tuesday. What did Matt Harvey say?
Matt Harvey, first of all, yeah, he demanded immunity in order to cooperate. Although it's still not clear to me immunity from what exactly.
Huh.
But the first thing out of the gate is the government asked him about his history of drug use. And he said on the stand, cocaine. He was a cocaine user until he met Tyler Skaggs. And that Tyler Skaggs, one day in spring training, when they're teammates for the first time, showed him a blue pill and said, this is oxycodone. Harvey says he told him that's not really my thing. I'm a cocaine guy. But at some point, he did try it. And he also talked about his own Percocet use. He actually was getting confused between Percocet and oxycodone. Sometimes said oxycodone when he meant Percocet. But the point was that he was an opioid user as well.
And how did Matt Harvey characterize his drug use? And what did he say he saw from his teammates in the Angels clubhouse?
He was the first one to open the door to just how brazen this, you know, drug life was inside the clubhouse. Not saying it was everybody, but what they said was that Tyler Skaggs introduced them to Eric Kay, that they trusted Eric Kay because Skaggs vouched for him, and that when they needed drugs, they would reach out to him. They would text him and he would leave something in their lockers or in their shoes. They'd either Venmo him money, sometimes use a different app, or they would just leave cash. Guys would sometimes use it in the clubhouse. Some guys were using it during games. There was a text from Tyler Skaggs to Matt Harvey where he asked him for a Percocet saying, I want to be loosey-goosey when I pitch.
Mm.
Matt Harvey talked about, you know, pitching while he was high. He brought up something that the defense had mentioned previously, and that we reported Eric Kay told the DEA when he met with them, that the regular practice for Tyler Skaggs was he'd get a pill, he'd go straight into the bathroom in the clubhouse, crush the pill on top of the metal toilet paper dispenser in a stall, and then snort it from that.
Yeah, TJ, just to be very clear about this, it is wild that we're talking about a member of the front office, the team's PR guy, getting accused of being a drug dealer. And I'm curious about what Eric Kay's communications were like with Matt Harvey that week where Tyler Skaggs died.
Yeah, not just a team employee, the one who spends the most time with the media. I mean, that's, you know, part of what's so crazy
yes,
about this.
Yes.
You know, Matt Harvey said that on occasion he would go to Eric Kay for drugs, and that on the day they were going to fly to Texas, Harvey found out that he was not going to be making that trip. He was injured at the time. He was really upset. And he said that he disappeared in the clubhouse because everybody else is having fun with their cowboy outfits, and he wasn't invited to the rodeo. And he went to go use the tub and was so depressed that he asked Eric Kay if he could get him something. And so that Eric Kay gave him a blue pill, which, you know, they believe to be oxycodone. He said he didn't use it right away, decided, you know what, I'm going to snap out of it. And then he hears the next day that Tyler Skaggs has died. The first thing he thinks of is that it had to be the drugs. And he said he took that pill and he threw it away because he was terrified that the same thing could happen to him.
And so the question does emerge, TJ, even though Matt Harvey is saying in the case of that specific blue pill that he did not take it, given that he acknowledged using opioids and cocaine throughout his baseball career, should he have been caught by Major League Baseball in some sort of testing procedure then?
There was no way to do it. The baseball has to bargain their drug policy with the union, and the policy they had was they can only test somebody for drugs of abuse if there's probable cause. You can't just randomly test them like for a performance-enhancing drug. So, you know, before, unless, you know, somebody did something, you know, that was credible cause, they didn't have a way to test them. They have it now, by the way. You know, they did change the policy in 2019 after Skaggs' death that they will test for opioids and cocaine. Matt Harvey and those other players, when you swear in court that you did it, that's cause. So I have spoken to people at Major League Baseball. If Matt Harvey manages to sign with the team, they will seek a suspension for distribution because he admitted to giving it to somebody else. He could fight it. I don't know how he'd do on appeal, but it's a 60 to 90 day suspension. The other players who testified on Tuesday and Wednesday, they just admitted to use. So they would be presumably referred to treatment, unlike Harvey.
So the other players who took the stand here, CJ Krohn, Mike Morin, Cam Bedrosian, they're lesser stars than Harvey, and I'm curious what the significance of their testimony was as you saw it.
Well, the bigger thing is laying out, from the government's perspective, that multiple guys were getting it from Eric Kay, therefore he's a distributor, and that they were, for the most part, only getting it from Eric Kay. They pointed out that when Eric Kay was in rehab earlier that year, even Tyler Skaggs seemed unable to get drugs. Now, the defense is saying, well, that's not true. We've already named a couple of other sources. But you have to wonder, from the government's perspective, is that enough to show that he was a dealer? Or from what they were describing, you know, Tyler Skaggs was the connection. Was he a dealer? You know, Tyler Skaggs isn't on trial, you know, in a literal sense. But in a lot of ways, the defense is putting Tyler Skaggs on trial.
Right, the man who's actually on trial and facing potential jail time is Eric Kay. And if he is convicted, TJ, what does Eric Kay face?
If you look at worst case scenario, it could be like 20 years. First time offender, no violence. There's just no reason he would get that full amount. It really would be up to the discretion of Judge Means. And it also depends on, you know, would the jury go for some sort of compromise where, okay, we're not going to get him on the wrongful death, but we will convict him on the distribution charge? That's all going to play into it.
And then after the criminal trial comes what?
There is a civil suit that is going on. The Skaggs family sued the Angels for negligence, both in California and in Texas. Now, Eric Kay was a party to... He was one of the defendants in the California case, but he's been dismissed from that. So he's no longer a defendant. But you've got lawyers watching every minute of this. The Angels attorney is in there and the Skaggs family attorneys are in there, because what happens here is going to play into that civil case in a huge way.
TJ, it occurs to me at the very end here that you have covered this game for so long, and I'm curious what covering this trial has taught you about that sport beyond just the circumstances, the tragic death of one specific 27-year-old pitcher.
I think we tend to think of these things as stories that come and go, like the drug trials with the cocaine in Pittsburgh in 1985, and then we had the steroid era. And the reality is that ball players have all the same temptations, one generation to the next, and now it is hitting head on with this national opioid crisis in a way that no sport has had to deal with up till now. You hadn't heard fentanyl, you know, really dealing with professional athletes. And now all of a sudden, you've got the story of these two guys, Eric Kay, a guy in the front office, and Tyler Skaggs, a guy on the field. And both of them were addicts who could not break out of that addiction. And it took one of their lives. And not one person who was connected to this will ever be the same. I mean, this is a story that is being told all over this country, you know, seeing sort of in a sharpness through Tyler Skaggs' life that we haven't seen before.
TJ Quinn, thank you for staying on this case, and thank you for reporting this story.
Thanks, Pablo.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.